Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
Thank you so much for joining us again as we explore the exciting world of business of emerging science, nanotechnology, defense, open innovation, energy. Today we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, visit our fountain of useless information we have here on the set in the second half of the program, and of course at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. Right now, though, we're going to step into our very busy world newsroom. Well, the lead story, of course, is the EPA, right before Christmas, announced it's going through with its plans to go around Congress and enforce cap and trade. Carbon emissions, and we're going to pay close attention to that because that's going to be the subject of our program today. In the meantime, the other news, Neil Reynolds reports in that the American Petroleum Institute in the United States has produced more crude oil in October than it ever has produced in a single month, and he suggests that this reversal of trend could reflect the beginning of the end for U.S. dependence on Mideast oil. And for Betty Pizer in London, U.K., the Energy Secretary Chris Hume plans to raise carbon tax. The wholesale price of electricity in the U.K. could rise by 72% by 2030. Okay, now back to our lead story and the subject of today's program. Just before Christmas, the Environmental Protection Agency carried through on its threat, went around Congress, and imposed its own emission standards for power plants. Cap and trade. The very program that has been so devastating to power rates in other countries. The cap and trade bill, of course, in short, caps the amount of carbon emissions that a power plant can emit into the atmosphere and allows them to purchase carbon offsets to when they exceed those emission standards. Of course, this is costly, and the power companies are going to have to pass the cost on to consumers. Well, the argument for cap and trade was made very eloquently by our dear friend, the late Stephen Schneider of Stanford University, on this very program.
My opinion is that you cannot make a market work if the price doesn't reflect all the costs. So the actual price of coal, for example, is not just extraction and transport, you know, and profit, but it also includes the damage to the lungs of children from the air pollution, the fact that the mercury means you can't eat more than one fish a month in Minnesota. I mean, things like that are part of the cost. So they've got to be inside the price. Otherwise, how can a free market work if people have the wrong incentives? So that's exactly, and this is not some radical view of a scientist, this is the economists that made this argument. They call it an externality. That means that the damages from rising sea level, which affects fisheries and coastlines, is not in the cost of energy. Well, then how can you make the right decision if you don't have the right price? Well, there's no way the market by itself can do that. This is what the economists call market failure. And that's the role of government. Government has to set some kind of either regulation or some kind of rule to internalize, is the word the economists use, the externalities. That means the things that are not part of the price of doing business. The cap and trade, as you asked, Colonel, that's one way to do it. The other way is just simply to have a dumping fee and say, well, you can't dump your waste. You can't take, you know, my garbage, I pay $4 a week to have the guys come and pick up my can. In fact, I pay $5 because I'm lazy and I have them come up my driveway. Why isn't it free? Because there's labor, there's the truck, and there's the landfill free. Why is my tailpipe or somebody's smokestack free? It's a complete violation of free market principles. And that's part of the reason why we've been polluting with impunity and this stuff has been building up. So what cap and trade is it says, okay, pollution is potentially dangerous, let's cap it, but in order to save money, if you're a company that's very, very clever and you can meet your quota at a very cheap price, that means you'll do better than your quota and you have a cushion. Well, you can sell that cushion to a company that's less clever and can't meet its quota at a cheap price. So that way, everybody wins, and it gives an incentive for the good company to get even better and for the bad company to start doing something about it because they're tired of paying fees to the good company. And so cap and trade works in that way. It can be administratively cumbersome because who's going to monitor what's going on? You don't want too much bureaucracy. There are problems that I would not deny. I'm personally a preferer of a carbon tax, and my basic view is it's a use fee for the atmosphere. If we're dumping in the atmosphere, why should it be free when it's not free to the rest of the world? And that's so much easier because you could collect it, you know, right through the tax law, situation, through the tax, you know, bureaucracies, without creating a new bureaucracy. The problem with that is that the public is so anathema, even in liberal states, to taxes, that no politician has the guts to utter the T word. So they do cap and trade because it's not a direct tax, but in fact, if it's administered well, it's going to have what we call a shadow price on carbon. That's how much it's going to cost the industry to meet the cap. Well, how is that in some ways different than if you're just basically charged for the pollution, by a pollution fee? But then there are other things. Cap and trade is fine, or carbon tax, as long as you don't try to do it all overnight, that you ramp it up slowly and give people, you know, nobody out there has been dumping CO2 in the atmosphere for the purpose of messing up the climate. I don't think there's a coal miner or a guy who made a Hummer who did it to mess up the climate. They were just doing what they know how, but mess up the climate they're doing, so you've got to deal with it. But you've got to give them a transition. You have to give them, you know, a decade or two to adjust.
Okay, well, what you and I want to know is what's this going to cost you and me in the form of increased electrical rates? And what's this going to do to our already crippled economy? Well, in search of the answer to that question, we started with Congressman Michael Burgess, Republican from Texas.
Well, of course, the EPA did get an endangerment finding. I think it was last spring. A lot of people thought that that was an overstep, and in fact, Lisa Murkowski, the famous senator from Alaska, in June or July of this year, had an amendment to a bill that would have restricted the EPA's ability to regulate carbon. That failed, although it received a 53-vote majority. It was not the 60-vote necessary to cut off debate, so that motion failed in the Senate. And we're left now with this January 1st, January 2nd date where the EPA now says it has the ability to regulate carbon. If I could take a step back for just a moment, I mean, this is pretty much, and I don't want to be overly encompassing here, but this is pretty much the game plan of the administration, has been for some time. That is, if you can't get what you want through Congress, you get it through federal regulation. And this is not just with climate change. This is with health care. It's with financial regulation. We're seeing it also at the FCC. So it's a standard game plan. It's one that is, for me, as part of the legislative branch, it's pretty concerning, because whether it be climate change, whether it be health care, whether it be the FCC, you see great swaths of power that the legislative branch over the last 2 years has sort of ceded over to the administration. And the administration is not the least bit shy about taking advantage of that. What we're dealing with at the level of the Environmental Protection Agency is certainly one manifestation of that. And you will see others as the year goes forward, now that the president does not have at least a House of Representatives that's likely to enact his agenda. He'll find that it's perhaps more favorable to do more and more by federal regulation. And that sets up the tension between the legislative branch, or at least the House and the legislative branch, and the administration.
Okay, well, with that, we turn to Luke Popovich, who's a spokesman for the National Mining Association, a lobbying organization for the coal industry.
The EPA threatened that they were going to tighten up, and then, of course, right before Christmas, they decided that they would propose their first greenhouse gas standards for the coal-fired power plants and oil refineries. And what everybody is saying is, wait a minute, we see what this is happening over in Europe and other places. What's this going to happen to our energy costs? Can you enlighten us on that?
Well, what's likely to happen to our energy costs is that our costs will go up. And that is not really much conjecture about that. That seems to be a fairly well-established finding from a number of investment banks and consulting firms over the last 3, 4, 5 months, some even very recently as of a couple weeks ago, that have issued studies looking at the likely impact on utility costs that have to comply with these rules, and therefore the impact that they're likely to have on retiring or shutting down existing electricity generating units, because they will not be able to comply with these rules, and therefore how that feeds into higher costs from using more expensive fuels like natural gas and renewables in favor of the coal plants that will be shut down, that are typically provide much cheaper energy, so that the impact is likely to be on utilities, higher compliance costs, as much as 30 or 40 gigawatts of the existing capacity that we now have in the country being prematurely shut down, and therefore that feeds into higher electricity bills for households that depend on these generating units. So you're liable to see widespread repercussions. The question is, to what extent those costs will be felt in the next 3 to 5 years, and that may depend on how the rules are finally managed, how the compliance will be monitored, whether the states will have the wherewithal to tailor and customize the rules given the power plants in their states. And that all remains to be seen. But again, I think there's little doubt that higher costs are in the wings.
Interestingly enough, on the same day that the EPA carried through with its threat to overstep Congress on the process of capping carbon emissions from coal power plants, they seized the permit power to license power plants from the state of Texas. Needless to say, Texas is mad as a wet hen. Lucy Nashard spoke to us from the governor's office.
As you may know, we've challenged the EPA's endangerment finding and greenhouse gas rules in federal court, and the cases are currently moving forward. The EPA is interpreting the Clean Air Act in a way Congress never intended, setting arbitrary greenhouse gas emission levels and ignoring statutory guidelines of the act. The EPA's misguided plan paints a huge target on the backs of Texas agriculture and energy producers by implementing unnecessary, burdensome mandates on our state's energy sector, threatening hundreds of thousands of Texas jobs and imposing increased living costs on Texas families. The federal government should instead be looking to Texas' strategy, which has successfully cleaned the air in this state while protecting jobs, all without harmful mandates. And as Texas led the nation's job and economic growth, the Texas Clean Air Program achieved a 22% reduction in ozone and a 53% decrease in NOx emissions, a greater reduction than the nation as a whole. Additionally, Texas's policies have allowed us to reduce greenhouse emissions more than any other state except Louisiana since 2000. And we will continue to advance new clean energy technologies by using market incentives and stable regulation rather than costly mandates and overreaching regulation.
Turning again to Congressman Burgess from Texas, he holds Dick Armey's old seat in Congress.
Well, now the EPA has seized the permit power from Texas. And the Dallas Morning News has reported that a spokesman for the governor says that the new rule is unnecessary because Texas has cut pollution with market incentives. And also says the EPA is misguided because it paints a huge target on the, that's a quote, a huge target on the back of Texas agriculture and energy producers by implementing unnecessary burdensome mandates on our state's energy sector, threatening hundreds of thousands of Texas jobs and imposing increased cost of living on Texas families. What is this going to do to energy prices? Do you have an idea?
Well, it will make them go up. The question with the new mandates as far as Texas is concerned, obviously this is something that's going to go to the courts as to who really has the authority here. The EPA is stating that they are simply trying to provide a framework for businesses in which businesses and electricity generators can operate. Since the state of Texas did not enact their own standards, the state of Texas is maintaining that the EPA is meddling where it had no business in going. So we'll see what happens with that. Clearly there will be a great deal of time and energy spent trying to sort that out. But I think the bigger question is, you know, look, I'm from Texas. We've had it better here in Texas than many other parts of the country. When you come to looking at things like the effects of the recession, job creation, Texas has done measurably better than many of its other counterparts. And if you were running the country, why in the world would you want to hurt the one state that is functioning well? It's just beyond me. And unless there is a larger political agenda, and I'm not cynical enough to believe that there is, but unless there is a larger political agenda, why would you single out the one state that is arguably performing head and shoulders above the other states?
Well, the other question that occurs to me, too, is that how the EPA believes that they can enforce cap and trade, which is what essentially this is, under the Clean Air Act. They have to say that they believe CO2 is a pollutant, and yet we all spews CO2. Plants thrive on CO2. How can CO2 be considered a pollutant? Do you think, that's my question then, do you think that the Clean Air Act really suggests that, which is apparently a good act to keep pollutions out of the air, but that should include something like CO2?
If that is the interpretation, it's an overbroad interpretation, and then it comes back to the legislative branch to provide the clarity of thought. Legislative intent was never, in my opinion, was never meant to restrict the production of carbon dioxide. We all produce, just by virtue of the fact that we breathe in and out several times a year, we all produce a half ton of CO2 individually. And look, the broader debate is about the occurrence of man-made CO2 causing or driving climate change in the broad perspective. I don't know that anyone would argue that climate change is not occurring, but is this occurring as a result of natural forces, solar cycles, changes in the Earth's orbit, you name it, anything else other than CO2, but it seems like we have fixated on carbon in the atmosphere as being the culprit. And yet, no one can convincingly tell us that CO2 does not go up as a consequence of climate change rather than the other way around. But nevertheless, you have a large intergovernmental panel at the United Nations who said, we've got a consensus opinion that it's man-made CO2. Well, then the question becomes, follow the money. Who is going to profit from this climate change legislation?
Yeah,
it's not you and me.
Yeah.
It is certainly other countries may profit. The big banks, the big banks, there's no question about it, the bond traders, will profit from this. You wonder why you haven't heard much out of some of these folks about what climate change legislation might do to the economy, because they're in fact going to do very well. In fact, the head of General Electric has been a big proponent of some of the cap and trade legislation, but you got to figure who's going to come out ahead in this deal. Well, he's likely to do very well. Mr. and Mrs. America paying their light bill is not likely to do so well in this exchange.
Okay, so how really dependent are we on coal? Well, I ask Luke Popovich. We really depend on coal-fired power plants in this country, I believe. How much of our power currently comes from coal? Can you enlighten us on that?
Roughly half, about 48% of all the electricity generated in the United States comes from coal, and it surprises, I think, a lot of people to realize it is that high when we keep reading about wind and solar power that is being added to the grid. But what people have to understand is that, yes, that is being added to the grid, but at a very, very low base. If you take out hydropower, for example, renewables only contribute about 4% to the entire electricity generation market here in the United States. Coal is 48%, natural gas is about 21-22%. So if you start dropping coal plants out of the picture, then you are really affecting the supply of what we call baseload capacity, that is the 24/7 electricity that we all depend on to run, keep the lights on, the air conditioning on, and everything else.
Well, the coal, of course, emits things, and of course we're trying pretty hard to clean up coal, and I think there's a lot of movements in that direction. We've had some guests on this program talking about it in the past. Of course, hydroelectric plants don't emit anything, but then again, we can't. There isn't enough room to build any more hydroelectric plants. I think we've about exhausted them. So if we want to turn the light, and we know that wind is unreliable, and we know that solar is unreliable and isn't sophisticated enough yet. So if we want the lights to go on, we have to rely on coal. Is that what you're saying?
We really do.
And interestingly enough, a former nuclear engineer and now coal advocate at Coal Logix, Bill McMahon, concurs.
Some of the old nuclear plants are looking to get retired, some of the old coal plants. We were requiring between 7,000 and 8,000 megawatts a year of new generation, so we're going to have to fill that in with something. I don't know how to do that today with anything other than coal and gas. So, you know, I'm afraid that we are writing a that we're running a deficit, an energy deficit in the country, and we're going to come out of this recession and downturn. We're not going to have the infrastructure, and we're not going to have the energy to be able to sustain a growth going forward, and we're going to give up our spot on the ladder of the world to others.
So McMahon feels that if we continue to cripple coal, that we're going to cripple America. And Popovich says that our use of coal isn't as dirty as the EPA is making it out to be.
And it's not as much of a dilemma as sometimes the environmentalists make it out to be, because technology is changing greatly in the coal combustion area, just as technology is changing in every other aspect of your life, from your old clunky desktop computers that 20 years ago seemed to be state-of-the-art. The engine in your car 20 years ago bears no resemblance to the engine that you're using today if you buy a new car. And we're seeing the same significant changes in the ability in power plants to reduce the amount of pollution and the emissions that come out of coal-fired generation. EPA lists that progress on its website. It's there for anyone to see. So I think from 1998 until 2007, which is the latest year we have data, the power plants in this country have reduced all their regulated emissions by about 45%. Now that's a striking change in just 20-30 years. So we can look forward to, I think, to increasingly dramatic and significant reductions in emissions. Right now, we're trying to tackle CO2 in order to address climate change. And that technology is maybe about 10 to 12 years out, but that is not a long time when you're talking about the energy field, where it takes 6 to 8 years to even permit a plant, let alone build it. So I think there's a lot to be very encouraged about on the technology front. The question is, will the regulators allow us the time to develop the technology before they start shutting down all this affordable power?
Well, of course, that's a key question, and that's one of the things our listeners are very concerned about. And after the break, I'm going to ask you what the National Mining Association is going to do about these EPA abuses, and we'll also ask Congressman Burgess if there's some solutions in Congress. Stick around.
Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
Dashuan Feng, National Cheng Kung University. Culture is what binds people together. Politics is what divides us.